CliffCentral.com. Love.
Yes, it's 2002, Anne-Marie, and it's not, it's 2020 now. So she's reminiscing about a time when we didn't have COVID and we didn't have all the challenges of what we're dealing with in the world at the moment. But we do have the Burning Platform to help us navigate the way forward. And fortunately today, as always, we have some interesting and informed voices to hopefully give you some perspective. I really genuinely did try to get Pierre Defosse to come on my TV show. I can show you the direct messages. He was very polite, said he unfortunately won't be able to make it, so he politely declines. But I try to get as many varied voices on the Burning Platform too as possible. It's just interesting that there are not very many people who actually will come on here. They're terrified of Canton, obviously. Isn't that right, Canton? I mean, you are terrifying.
You know, the fascinating thing is that I'm supposed to be on a show this coming Friday. It's called the Fuck Up Project or something similar. You know, where one is meant to describe things that one has done in business where, you know, one has made an actual fuck up.
Yeah.
Because, and I think it's a great concept because just consider that, you know, everyone who runs a business
has screwed up at some point.
Yeah. And the way in which you deal with those things are object lessons for other people. So they invited me to come on board. And then there was a person who I've never heard of who very publicly pulled out because he/she will not share a platform with me. You know, and I find this quite fascinating.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So someone you've never heard of, who you don't know you've ever met, is not prepared
absolutely.
To be. Yeah, this is interesting. We can get into it a little bit later on. There's so many things to talk about. But this morning, because of a report that I picked up on from Herman Pretorius, who's the Deputy Head of Policy Research at the IRR, I thought it would be interesting to have him on. So Herman, welcome. And the Burning Platform this morning, brought to you, as always, by Nando's, who are unafraid of having a share of voice in all of the crazy discussions that we do have in South Africa. They know the big picture is that eventually we all have to talk to each other, even if we disagree. And it's better that we start with that attitude and we get cracking on the important things that make South Africa interesting, rather than avoid each other and fight and don't make any progress. So Herman, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Jared. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for Nando's for not being chicken.
Very nice.
He's been waiting to say that for the longest time.
All right, but, guys.
I have a question before we start, though, Herman.
Go on.
If you're the deputy head of policy, who is the head?
Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. Now, I'm not ashamed to say
okay,
that.
Okay, so Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. So in other words, you are the David Mabuza to Anthea Jeffrey Cyril Ramaphosa.
In fact, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about my position at the IRR. Thanks.
All right. So now that you've been thoroughly disabused of any superiority complex you might have had before, so let's get into what you actually do. You, as the head of policy research, what does that involve, deputy head of policy research? What do you do? Do you compile reports? Do you look at figures? Do you talk to other people? Do you make political statements? What sort of stuff is your daily work?
Yeah, all of the above. You see, the thing is, if you're in policy research and you work at the Institute of Race Relations, you're in the business of understanding problems and proposing solutions. So wherever you need to go, whether it's to the data, whether it's to, you know, on the ground interviews, wherever you need to go to understand the problems, to see the problems clearly, there you go. And then wherever you need to go to find the solutions, there you go as well.
All right. Now, I don't mean to start a fight right at the beginning of our discussion, Herman, but do you really think that in politics in 2020, most people are looking for solutions? And I'm not being sarcastic here. There's a lot going on in politics in the world, and you can pick in any number of examples, where people are actually not particularly interested in real solutions. They're not interested in solving problems. They're interested in complaining about them forever. And if you solve the problem, you give them a reason to stop existing. And for many people in politics, that is exactly counterproductive to what they're in politics for. And I don't have to name names. You know who I'm talking about. There are lots of people on the left and the right who actually aren't interested in solutions. So aren't you guys fighting a losing battle here by thinking about things and coming up with plans and proposing solutions?
Well, if we're going to be cynical, I think our work might give, you know, might up the standard and quality of complaining, at least. But if we're going to be more ideological and perhaps more, Broadway musical dreamlike, yeah. I do think that there is a, our research over the last few decades, it continues to show that there's a solid chunk of South Africans in the middle of the political spectrum who are moderates, who are common sense people. And the idea of a silent majority is such a cliche, so I'm not going to use it, but I might just attempt to invoke it. Just three brief examples. 83% of South Africans, according to our research, say that national sports teams should be selected on merit and not on skin color.
83%?
83% of all South Africans, 82% of black South Africans, 83% of all South Africans. 76% of all South Africans agree with the statement that with better education and more jobs, inequalities between races will eventually disappear. Not get better, disappear.
That's and amazing.
And the third one that I enjoy because I really think it shows the pragmatism and the common sense of ordinary South Africans actually is if we ask the question, who do you think should get jobs in South Africa? You've got an option, only black people until demographically representative. But the two top performing answers, 20% of the public say jobs should be given on merit alone, but 58% of South Africans say that jobs should be awarded on merit with special training and special opportunities to improve skills for disadvantaged. And I just think that shows such a pragmatic centrist view to say that, you know, merit vitally important. Yeah. Let's expand merit.
I hear you and I agree with you on much of what your research seems to indicate, that most South Africans are sensible and they want to live their lives and they want to feed their children and send them to schools and hopefully have a better future than their own parents had. That seems to me almost, you know, a given, and your research backs it up, so I'm pleased about that. But what I'm really talking about is the politicians. They don't always want solutions, do they? Because it puts them out of business ultimately. I mean, like
that's not particular to us in this country. Yeah?
No. I'm saying it's international. Yeah. I mean, you can see this with Bill de Blasio in America, for example. And this is just the most recent example. So Bill de Blasio is the mayor of New York. New York has seen a massive upswing in crime over the last month and a half, and that's largely as a result of something we'll talk about in a minute, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, which is, as a movement, questionable, but certainly the slogan and the meaning of the term Black Lives Matter is indisputably a good one. Now, Bill de Blasio is so busy virtue signaling about what a good guy he is that he's painted Black Lives Matter in big yellow letters in front of Donald Trump's building on Fifth Avenue, where Donald Trump doesn't currently live, by the way. He's doing nothing to curb the actual deaths of black people in neighborhoods which are overwhelmingly underpoliced and under-resourced in New York. Instead, he's just doing what gets him in the headlines and what makes people think he's a nice person. But you understand my point. You come along, Herman, with your ideas about how we can solve problems. And there are politicians in this country, like Bill de Blasio in America, who will just do the performative stuff to look like they're good people without actually making a difference. Don't you agree that that's a much bigger problem than some of the problems themselves?
Yes and no. I think one or two points in response to that. I think the first thing that looking at historical and current data and research and, you know, just the trend of politics over the last 200, 300, even 1,000 years, is firstly that politics has always been a sewer. I don't think we're in a uniquely awful time for politics. I mean, if you read some of the pamphlets and attack pamphlets, the equivalent of tweets of the early American elections, you see exactly the same kind of petty schoolyard politics going on there. So I think the first thing that we should be honest about is not to romanticize the past only because the best ideas survived. I think there's a duty on people to look into history, not just for the best of humanity, but for the worst, to acknowledge that, you know, there's always been this flow of excrement through our public debate. So I think that's the first thing. And secondly, I would say that politicians being a problem, and here I need to qualify it a bit. I'm not one of those people, you know, absolutely cynical about politicians. I know a few who I genuinely think are good people trying to do a good job. And
would you engrave their names on a toothpick for us? Because I'm sure they'll all fit on there, and you can send one to each of us.
Yes, I think a few of them are now dead.
I'm sorry.
But you know,
and that explains it. Well, there you go.
Yes. No, but I do think that you've got some decent politicians still across the world. I do think you can count them on the one hand. Gareth, just let me finish this point. I do think that there have been instances where the public's hunger for solutions overruled politicians' hunger for attention and idiocy.
Power to that. I don't think anyone disagrees. And I didn't bring you on here to grill you right at the start. There are things on your agenda that we'll get to in a second, Hadman. Canthan and Hadman, you brought up something just now, and then I'll leave you to pursue your own agenda for the morning. But you brought up Didi Mabuza. I know you brought him up as a joke because he is a joke. But where is this man? We are paying.
I don't think of him as a joke at all, Gareth.
Let me just pose the question, because we've been through inarguably the most critical and difficult period for certain people, I mean, in living history, for many of us, for a long time. Indisputably, this is a time where we require leadership, and we need people to stand up and be counted. Even people who we disagree with a lot of the time. I mean, I said this morning, I feel a little bit sorry for Angie Motshekga, because she's constantly on the griller in terms of trying to get people back to school. She's dealing with SADTU. She looks like she's having a really rough time. And I do believe that there might be some part of all of these ministers who are trying to do their best, even though they may make mistakes. And I'm willing to be forgiving, because all governments in the world have made mistakes. Didi Mabuza, though, our deputy president, a man we pay an enormous salary to, has been conspicuously absent, to say the kindest thing I can say about him. What are we paying this man to do? I know that Cyril is paying him because he brought him a block of votes at the CODESA ANC election. But what are we paying for him to do as a country? And where is this guy? And why has he been so derelict? Please, answers. I'll take any comers.
No, Gareth, we have such short memories. Now ask yourself, for the 5 years that Cyril Ramaphosa was deputy president to Jacob Zuma, where was he?
So what is that job? What does that job entail?
It's exactly the point that I was making earlier to Herman, relative to his position with Anthea Jeffries. You are waiting in the wings in order to be able to slip the knife between the third and fourth ribs.
Canthan, I told you that in confidence.
Oh, God.
This is terrible. We're all friends here, Herman.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a wonderful line that Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom, while he was still, you know, head honcho of the Labour Party, used to describe his involvement with some questionable...
Wait. Hang on a second. I remember this line. My name is Jeremy Corbyn. My pronouns are has and he.
No, that's not the line.
No, I think you're wrong there. I think his pronouns are never was, but I mean, to be a has-been is something. To be a never was is quite worse. But I think Michael Gove used it in a speech in the Commons to say that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn defended his attendance of some pretty interesting ceremonies with some pretty awful people by saying he was present but not involved. And I think that pretty much that phrase sums up a lot of our politicians, present but not involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think if you look in terms of the entire strategic outlook that Mabuza has had, Gareth, to come back to you, remember that he refused to accept his seat in Parliament until he'd gotten a declaration that he was actually cleared of wrongdoing.
Yes.
So in other words, he got a free pass before he got in, which means he can now kick back and say, okay, this is the problem of everyone else in the administration, not me. I'm clean. Yeah, he's been playing his cards very well. And don't underestimate for a second that he has a substantial following within the ranks of the ANC. And he has been very carefully laying the brickwork in place, which Ramaphosa has not been doing, because Ramaphosa has not built anything successfully in his entire period in his life. You know, he's the Donald Trump of South Africa, really, you know, except Donald Trump has actually run a business, whereas Ramaphosa has simply bought businesses with other people's money.
And I think Donald Trump, at least, has also looked at people and said, you're fired.
Which definitely Cyril has not done, right?
Never.
Okay. All right. That having been said, let's look at some of the other things that are going on. I know that Herman wrote this really interesting report, and the reason this is pertinent to South Africa is because the ANC has said that they are in lockstep in support of Black Lives Matter. So let's talk a little bit about BLM and what this means. The ideology, I want us to talk about race, because race is at the center of not only American politics right now, but it has been at the center of South African politics for much longer. We have to talk about ideology here. And I think this requires a little bit of philosophy and intellectual discourse, and then we can get into more of the current affairs and the solutions that you've proposed to some of those, Herman. So you take it off my hands here, the BLM ideology. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, first things first, I would be remiss if I didn't give the vast bulk of the credit to my the IRR's tamed Rasputin, Gabriel Krause, who is really
held him on. We had him on just the other day, yeah.
Yeah, no, I can only apologize. But he held the pen for definitely the largest part of this this BLM report. So in summary, where does BLM come from? Well, it started as a hashtag. It started as a social movement. It started by three activists. And we put the faces of these three activists on the cover of this report. And we did that deliberately for a few reasons. Firstly, if someone has endorsed Black Lives Matter and they look at this report and they wonder why did the Institute of Race Relations put three random black women on the cover of this report, then it's a betrayal of terrible ignorance, because the three women on the cover have names, and their names are Alicia Garza, Opal Tumeti, and Patrice Kolloz, the three activists who are really the force behind Black Lives Matter. So they established Black Lives Matter in 2013. Mm-hmm. And they are very talented activists. I mean, really, I've got some grudging respect for them. They are very, very good activists, because by the time of 2015, when Michael Brown dies in Ferguson, Black Lives Matter and another slogan, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, really become central tenets of the race, political race discussion in America. And they capitalize on that, I think, brilliantly. Just like I think David Mabuza is a brilliant politician, these three women have some great talent. And from there, they institutionalize this social sentiment. They become a multi-million dollar organization. They work with managers, with professional entities. They establish head offices in Delaware, which is essentially a tax haven state. And we estimate their total asset value is around $3.4 million. That's not including salaries. And if you look at 2020, they have in this year alone fundraised at least $36 million.
That's so the first incredible. Thing you should,
it is. It's terrifying. And the first thing that people should realize is that this isn't a sentiment. You're not endorsing a sentiment. As the slogan, Black Lives Matter, is so sound, but I warn people against the North Korean mistake. You know, the North Korean mistake in my vocabulary is to think that North Korea is democratic, belongs to the people, is a republic, and covers the whole Korean peninsula, just because its name says it's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And you shouldn't make the North Korean mistake with Black Lives Matter. Sentiment is sound. Obviously, Black Lives Matter. Only, you know, a fundamental idiot would argue with that.
Sure.
But what they very smartly did is they weaponized a very decent sentiment, and they've, I think, duped a lot of people who didn't do homework.
So what's wrong with the movement that isn't wrong with the slogan? Because I haven't met anybody who said, no, black lives definitely don't matter. I've never met anyone who says that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the movement, Gareth, if you support a basic Marxist reconstructionist agenda for your society.
Okay. So let's go back. I'm really pulling the veil back as far as I can here, because I know that it's important where I can tell that you and Herman agree on a lot of things for me to be the devil's advocate. So what's wrong with a little Marxism? He said, a little. What's wrong with a little? Isn't that like a way to bring some compassion, a bit of social safety into a very wrong, nasty, brutal capitalist system?
No. Do you want me to elaborate on that? No, I'm kidding. There's a wonderful quote by Margaret Thatcher that says that, you know, compassion is all good and well, but you need cash. And I think that's why I firmly am opposed to Marxism, not because of its blatant historical failings, but because it might be good at diagnosing problems. It's awful at proposing solutions. And if you look at the ideology, I think there's nothing wrong with a very successful activist organization that has almost $40 million in riches. I think that's good fundraising.
By the way, where do they spend that money, and where do they send that money?
I'm actually not quite sure.
Let me climb in on this point. A lot of these, the links that you get on the Black Lives Matter website, and by the way, for people's information, this is blacklivesmatter.com, where they actually put in place fundraising. And a lot of those actually go into groups that support Democratic candidates for election in the U.S.
Oh, so in other words, it's really a front for the Democratic Party then to raise money.
Well, for particular sectors of the Democratic Party, yes. So, you know, for example, you know, one can safely assume that they are putting money behind the likes of the Squad, as an example.
Okay. All right. No, I just wanted to clear that up before we carried on, because otherwise it will be raised by someone. We've got very smart listeners here who will no doubt bring it up.
I think, but just as a general, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's front for the Democratic Party. I think that's you know, very narrow, but I think there is some element.
Herman, that's a good thing for you to say, because there might be a Democratic president next and we still want to get American money for the IRR. I agree.
We do.
I think he just sold you down the river.
Yes, it seems to be. No, but just for clarity's sake, I think like 7% of the IRR's funding comes from big donors. So just to get that out there. But I think
I'm not a big donor, not at all. I just give you a tiny bit.
Yes, but you're one of the thousand. Very, very kind. Right. But there's three things I think.
Copper paperclip, as I'm now going to refer to Sia, is shaking his head. Sia, by the way, I must tell you, good people who are listening, Sia has come out as identifying as a paperclip.
And that's why he's so still. That's why he's sitting so quiet, because he's stationary.
I just think Canton is in the mood to fire shots at any and everyone this morning.
This is either if you've just joined us now, you're either listening to The Burning Platform or the worst comedy gig in South African history. So let's proceed.
I mean, we are talking about politics. So, Gareth, do you think there's a difference? But I think three things that people need to understand about Black Lives Matter. Firstly, that it's not a sentiment. It's an organization and a movement with millions of dollars behind it. Secondly, it has a philosophical and an ideological bent and very strong identity in that regard, and very clear objectives. And thirdly, it is based on some legitimate grievances that we have to say. It is based on some legitimate grievances, but it weaponizes the goodwill of people who acknowledge those grievances but don't really look deeper to understand that while police brutality or police behavior might be a problem, you cannot automatically assume racism from that. The data doesn't support that kind of conclusion. So if people want to understand Black Lives Matter, understand those three things.
All right. I would encourage anyone who wants to hear more about this to go and read Herman's article. You can find that where, Herman, on the IRR website.
Yes, under reports, occasional reports.
Okay, let's come back to South Africa for a second. Government has They said in a tweet they posted on Wednesday that the cigarette and alcohol ban will last throughout lockdown. And then immediately after that, they had to correct themselves. Now, we all make mistakes, right? I've posted stuff sometimes and had to recall it. But government really, that on this issue in particular, on a day where there are actual restaurant protests and where people are really pissed off about this alcohol ban being reinstated, this is just such a misstep. Can either of you explain to me how GCIS works and whether or not it's a process, a system error this, or whether it's just because they actually don't care? It's just gross incompetence.
I've tried to work up enthusiasm to actually answer this question. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm feeling miserably. Herman, go for it.
Yeah, no, I think the question is, it reminds me, sorry to continue the bad joke trend, but it reminds me of the joke of the man and his son walking past the union buildings, and the son asked, Daddy, how many people work there in the union buildings? And he said, well, about a fifth of them. So the question of you know, is it incompetent? How does GCIS work? I think the simple answer is it doesn't, because it has this idea that it is supposed to communicate information to the people. And I'm not sure about anyone else's experience, but during this lockdown period, either communication has been lacking, or it has been bad, or it has been oppressive, or it has been confusing. I mean, that's the problem with governmental communication to the citizen, and that is an undermining of the rule of law.
Either way, I mean, it's clear that these kinds of missteps in communication can lead to people really making dangerous decisions. And it doesn't seem that the overall intention of government is to give people clear information. And we had Zweli Mkhize just the other day saying he doesn't think it's a good idea that we actually get any insight into the advice that he's receiving from doctors and hospitals and government advisors. He reckons that would confuse us more, because, of course, we can't make up our own minds. Do either of you have any thoughts on the transparency of all these advisors?
I think that Zweli Mkhize is absolutely right, because we've been stupid enough to vote for the ANC for the past 26 years. So surely he knows.
Well, that's...
I have to jump in there, because I do think, you know, that there's fair criticism of the South African vote to make, absolutely. But let's be honest, in a country where about 26 million people are of voting age, the ANC wins 55 to 60% of the vote with 10 million votes. I don't think that there's a mistake in not turning up to elections. There's a mistake, I think, in not participating in that democratic right. But I do think that it's also a mistake to tarnish all South African voters for electing this government. You see the turnout trends, and that's a failure of South African politics. But I think there is some nuance to the criticism, even if there's merit to it.
Herman, how dare you destroy my narrative with fact?
Yeah, no, it's an awkward thing that I've been trained to do at the Institute of Race Relations.
Yeah, let talking about GCIS, Gareth, you know, the fundamental issue has always been the question of cadre deployment rather than actually putting competent people in place.
Right.
And the problem with being a cadre is that before you can say anything, you have to wait for instructions from the chain of command. Mm-hmm. So you actually lack the ability to think on your feet.
I was on another radio station 2 weeks or so saying, you know, the question was, give us practical solutions. And one of the solutions I gave was end cadre deployment. And I think it was the president of the South African Commerce Chamber, I can't exactly be sure, but he came out swinging and said, no, there's nothing wrong with cadre deployment. It's just been implemented badly. Cadre deployment works in China. And I wish I had a chance to respond.
The head of what?
I think the South African Chamber of Commerce. Before I libel anyone,
my
I'll just...
My God, that person's in charge of the Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, but cadre deployment does work in China, because if you're not a cadre, you don't get a job.
Or you don't survive past, you know, infancy.
Yes, but unlike South Africa, in China, you actually do get fired.
Yes, and but
they execute it. But that's a minor inconvenience, I'm sure.
Yeah.
In Leon Schreiber's book, Coalition Country, I think one of the most interesting conclusions that he reaches in a fictitious scenario where the EFF and the DA might form a coalition government, which I think is highly unlikely, especially given the few years of experience since that book was published. Mm. But he does say that there is common ground to at least end cadre deployment. And I think if you run into an idea where someone actually says cadre deployment has worked and it can work, that just really explains the disconnect between
extraordinary.
Some of
the what a thing to say. I mean, that's just absolutely unbelievable. I'm really quite shocked, and it takes a lot to shock me. I don't cry easily. This is something that's very scary to me. A person in the Chamber of Commerce somewhere, they clearly are there to understand commerce, is busy praising China for CADA deployment. Unreal. There are a lot of people who shouldn't have positions that they have. My God.
Well, this cuts to the chase in terms of another point that a lot of us have been making for the longest time now, which has really been the fact that the corporate world in South Africa, big business, has actually been captured for the longest time. And if you look in terms of the reactions on the part of big business, so let's take a look at big alcohol.
Right.
Have they done anything to oppose the regulations that have effectively been kneecapping their businesses? No. It's in fact the small farms that are stepping up to the plate and saying we need to challenge these regulations. If you look in terms of big tobacco, have they been doing anything to actually take on these guys? Again, the answer to that is no.
Yeah.
Every single one of these regulations that have been demonstrably stripping billions and billions from the value of these companies who are listed on the JSE, but they are quiet. And the reason why they are quiet is because government is in a position to bludgeon them into submission and tell them either you play by our rules or we'll put in place regulations that are going to make it even worse for you. So the entire idea that you have any group that is able to speak on behalf of big business in this country and be able to make a meaningful contribution, we saw how that went with Real Causa many years ago. You remember when he stepped up to the plate and said, we need to do this?
Yeah.
We saw that happen with Michael Jordan when he was still at FNB, and he began that video campaign of voices from across the country expressing what they wanted in terms of hope for the country. And again, you know, FNB got threatened with all of the government business being pulled away from them. So this is the reality of the way in which the ANC works in this country.
It's a kind of corporate cancel culture.
It is a corporate cancel culture, and they have the real power to be able to implement cancel culture in this sense. You know, unlike the sentiment that pervades in the markets where you can actually appeal to people to say, stop buying Nike, as an example. Mm. On the other hand, you know, you could tell people stop buying Nando's and they will say never.
One of the things that that I've learned in my year at the Institute of Race Relations is the intense cowardice of corporate South Africa. Mm. Let's take EWC for an example. The IRR dragged the banking sector kicking and screaming into the EWC debate earlier this year when we launched an open letter campaign to all the major banks asking them a simple question. Will you expect your clients to pay off debts on properties expropriated by the government? And, I mean, credit to a few of them who actually came with a direct answer saying, yes, we would. But either they said, yes, we would be expecting South Africans to pay for the privilege of losing their property, or they tried to fudge the issue with some vague platitudes. The same with pension funds and prescribed assets. Corporate South Africa has about the backbone of a jelly bean.
Yes, but this is because there are widely held misconceptions on both sides. So government believes secretly when big business isn't listening that big business is just a stupid cash cow that will do what it's told. And they're probably right because that's been evidenced by their behavior. And big business is happy to glad hand politicians on the other side, and we know all about this, that they're in cahoots, and that ultimately the consumer, the customer, the taxpayer will pay And if they can just have a cozy relationship, then everything will be fine for everyone else. And we've seen evidence of both these attitudes from government. You know, the big businesses, and you bring up big liquor, but they've seen themselves as lobbyists, that they have an equal seat at the table. But government just give them lip service, right?
Yeah, and I think it hasn't been shown clearer than in two instances. Firstly, I think the mining sector over the last decade, working, you know, having the seat at the table philosophy, when government has really been issuing the most awful policies, destroying a once world leading sector. And, you know, this idea of if we're at the table, we can influence policy for the better. No, if you're at the table, you're a useful idiot most of the time. And then the second one is that I think there was a lot of let me name names. AgriSA came within a hair's breadth of endorsing a form of expropriation without compensation that might have resulted in medium and large scale commercial farms keeping their land, but the little guy, the family farmer, just being sold down the drain. And if it wasn't for you know, the IRR's Harry Rasputin, Gabriel Krause, then I do think that there might have been momentum to that idea, because they were in discussions in you know, close collaboration with the invisible man, Mr. Mabuza.
So basically, guys, if you're looking for a savior, big business is not it.
Well, big business is no longer big. You see, that's the second thing to take into account. If you look in terms of the value of the top companies on the JSE, let's say you remove Naspers from the equation and look at the collective value of all of those companies that are now listed on the JSE. Mm-hmm. There has been a systematic decimation of the value of those companies pretty much over the past 10 years. And that's not going to come back.
No.
That's a very crucial thing to recognize, because if you look in terms of Naspers's value, most of Naspers's value now, in fact, has been hived off into Prosus, and Prosus's value in turn is derived from Tencent, which again is in China.
Right.
And Magnus Haystack has written a pretty fabulous piece. I'll tweet a link to it again shortly, where he has been talking about the reason why so many of us as individual investors need to be taking our money outside the country. Just simply because of the fact that if we want to have any real rate of return on investment, we are not going to get it on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Just simply because nobody is going into the Johannesburg Stock Exchange now. So the number of companies that are listed on the JSE has dropped drastically. I think there's something like a 40% decline in the number of listed companies. And part of the reasons for this is that what one needs to have in place in order to get listed now is just so fucking onerous in terms of all of the race-based regulations, all of the quota-based regulations that one needs to deal with, that no one really has any interest in terms of putting up things on the JSE. So,
one thing that also has stood out to me engaging with corporate South Africa is there's a difference between being, you know, a highly accomplished person when it comes to finance and when it comes to economics. The two are separate issues. You can be a good businessman by understanding finance and by having a lot of skill and understanding of that without necessarily having an understanding of economics. Now, I don't give myself out as an expert on economics, but you have to acknowledge that economics is ideological. Economics is philosophical, or it's just the question of mass choice and where people choose to spend their money. And I think we often make the mistake of thinking that if someone is a successful business person, that means they understand markets and those kind of economic forces, when I don't think that's very often the case.
Okay, so as I said, you can't rely on these guys to be your savior if that was what you were hoping for. So who can we rely on? You mentioned small farmers who are now standing up to government. Who else is standing up to government? We know about the taxi associations. They certainly didn't take this lying down. They said F you right at the beginning. And people, I think by and large, were on their side. Public sentiment certainly isn't on the side of more lockdowns, more restrictions. You guys have researched that at the IR, haven't you, Herman? Have you got some figures there for us?
I don't have the figures offhand, but I think the support for the lockdown started at around 84% approval. Mm-hmm. And then after the fourth or fifth week, I think that we entered a trend where support dipped by 50% every week. So I don't have the latest figures on where the lockdown is at, but it just shows that Cyril Ramaphosa has a unique opportunity to waste golden opportunities of political capital to harness public support. He's had it three times on a national scale and failed all three times. But if we're going to ask who's going to save us, I think that's been a fundamental mistake in South Africa for about 100 years. It goes back to then. Yes. To the Anglo-Boer War, yes, where the Boer thought, you know, if only we can get the Germans involved in this. And it the Germans were never going to come. And I think there's a fundamental mistake in thinking that someone else is going to save us. If you look at history, if you're going to be honest, when the best decisions in South African history have been made politically, they've been made by the people. So if you're wondering, it's similar to why I went into politics rather than an alternative direction I was studying at the time, is the National Assembly passed the vote for expropriation without compensation. And not to aggrandize myself, but I've been in love with politics for many, many years. And I just thought, my goodness, if I don't change the course of what I'm doing and try to fight this moronic idea, then I really can't blame anyone else. And James Lindsay, the American thinker and the foremost critic of critical race theory, said the other day that debates are won by people who show up. And I think if there's one silver lining from the lockdown, especially if we look at yesterday's protest by SMEs across the country in the restaurant sector, people are starting to show up for the first time, I think, in 20 years.
It's taken 5 months of lockdown and threats of them actually losing their jobs, their livelihoods and food on the table to get some of these people to the table. But I'm delighted that finally we seem to have some kind of real public activism in respect to this. And I think it's also fair to say that suddenly we're starting to see a lot more noise coming from the liquor businesses, the tobacco industry. And thank God it's taken them long enough, but they're at least coming to the party now, right?
Yeah, I think the moment the scales must have fallen from most South Africans' eyes to see the government as an ideological actor and not a pragmatic solution seeker is when they made crop buttons and cooked chicken issues important enough for a cabinet member, a cabinet minister to deal with. That is small-minded in the most ridiculous sense. Up to that point, I think South Africans could have been, you know, going, oh, you know, it's the government's problem. I think lockdown has shown two things. Firstly, that goodwill in government is not, you know, the driving force. Too many people assume government is a benevolent entity. And the second thing I think that people must realize and are starting to realize is that we haven't been in lockdown for 5 months. We've been in lockdown for a decade, at least for a decade. Government has made economic activity nigh impossible for many South Africans who could have been wealth creators and job creators in this country. This isn't a new lockdown. This was an intensification and a making tangible of an ideological lockdown that's been gripping this country for a decade.
Do you agree with that, Canton?
I'm afraid so. And I don't have a solution in sight other than to set it up and wait for the new.
Right, sorry, we lost you for a second there. It just became a little buffered and unclear. But okay, I think we got the gist of that. Guys, the MPs want the Independent Police Complaints Directorate, the IPID people, to be given an amendment so that they can have greater say in selecting their head. And this comes after Minister Becky Trele nominated Jennifer Ntatseng as the new boss. A report supporting Ntatseng's nomination by Trele was supported by the Police Portfolio Committee, its meeting on Wednesday. Now, I'm interested in whether or not you think IPID works and whether that's the best way to hold police accountable. And also, who are the villains and who are the good guys in this story? What would you like to see happen with things like IPID? Herman, you go first.
Well, that's the question. Does God exist? And sum it up in three easy sentences. what do I want to see? accountability. And I don't think that you're going to get that through this centralized law enforcement approach. It's you know, it's heresy to praise the National Party, and as a classical liberal, I mean, my skin crawls when I have to do it. But in the early 90s, after 1991, I think between 91 and 93, they took some decent steps to decentralize and essentially federalize prosecuting authority and law enforcement powers to the four provinces, as then were, well, as we then had. But then the new dispensation re-centralized national law enforcement and prosecuting authority around the executive, the national executive. And I think that was a fundamental mistake. So I think the problem here is not who's heading IPED. I think the problem is that you don't have – it's a silly idea. I fundamentally dislike Chapter 9 institutions and institutions like IPED, because it is a bait and switch for real democratic accountability. It's politicians creating an accountability mechanism for themselves rather than, for example, having your local police commissioner being elected by the community itself.
You agree with that, Canton?
Yes, I do agree with that, because the if you look in terms of so many of the issues that we have right now in terms of the way in which policing takes place, and the very specific example that comes to mind is the Western Cape.
Right.
Where the Western Cape has been systematically under-resourced in terms of simply the numbers to start off with, in terms of police resources. And then secondly, the government of the Western Cape lacks the ability to actually direct the course of how policing actually takes place. So the situation for the gang-ridden areas of the Cape Flats is never going to improve as long as it is in the interests of the African National Congress to continue destabilizing those areas of the Western Cape, because it then gives them a narrative to be able to push in terms of how the DA is incapable of actually running the province, when in fact the DA is not in a position to actually deploy people to the areas as they see fit. They're not in a position to ensure that the appropriate resources are funneled through. They're not in a position to ensure that police stations are built where they need them to be. And they're not even in a position to dictate the number of patrol vehicles that you need in those areas.
Let me try and take this back to where we started with BLM. Police work better when they work on a local level, when the policemen, the decisions that those police precincts make are decisions that are localized, right? Because each area obviously has its own problems. And we talk about the Cape Flats, for example, very unique set of problems there. Very serious problems, but unique set of problems. The best people to deal with those problems are probably people from those neighborhoods.
That's absolutely right. And it comes back to the point that Herman made earlier, and which I and a number of other people have been making for years, that one of the ways in which you can sort this out most effectively is to have local communities elect their local police chief. Because that immediately creates a level of accountability that can, you see, very quickly, if you're not able to deliver at the local level in terms of your policing capability, then you vote that person out of office until things actually work correctly.
And I think if we're going to be honest, looking at history, what the racism of apartheid, I think, you know, it is the main criticism there, but we have to look deeper. It's not just that apartheid was racist. It is that it was centralized government to a very, very extensive degree. And Don Pinnock wrote a brilliant book, Gangtown, where he, I remember correctly, one of his first conclusions in chapter... can't remember, but
can actually listen to the interview. We had him on the show. You'll find his podcast among all the others on cliffcentral.com. But Don Pinnock's book, yeah, terrific book to read if you really care about the Western Cape and the problems that people are experiencing there. Good one.
And the point he made is that government had a massive role in you know, the ignition of the gang culture by having decisions enforced undemocratically on communities. So I think if you have racism and centralized power causing the problems of apartheid and that really continues in many areas today, then I think it's absolute madness to think centralization and more racism is the solution to the centralization and racism that previously went on. And another point I want to make is de facto, communities have taken over policing in many, many instances, especially in your informal settlement. If you look at the numbers of deaths due to so-called mob justice, I can't remember the exact figure. I think it was somewhere, let me not lie and name a figure, but it was very high and it was increasing because communities no longer have faith in the police. They no longer have even the instinct to contact the police when things go wrong. And that's why mob justice is not excusable, but understandable.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we've never really given enough time to discuss these particular problems in the Western Cape, because they're social, they're economic, they're obviously political, but they just seem insurmountable to the people in those communities so much of the time. And often government, instead of helping, ends up hindering processes. I feel like, you know, that's almost, the Cape Flats have almost been written off now. There's no one who wants to solve that problem anymore.
Except the communities.
No, of course, but they're not getting any help from the outside.
I think that's exactly the point, is that if you want a problem solved, go to the people who have skin in the game. And that's why I so appreciate what happened yesterday with the restaurants is, you know, I think SMEs are waking up and realizing that they have skin in the game. And something that Frans Cornier, our CEO, said to me yesterday or the day before yesterday is people should get out of the cities. People should get out of the cities and go to the rural areas to realize that in those areas, government is quite often a fiction.
Well, we know that. I mean, Stats SA and just recently the Statistician General, in fact, it was the Auditor General who released that report on how many of our municipalities are completely bankrupt and how many of them have clean audits. And it's a scary situation to deal with. I wonder if anyone in government is taking it as seriously as the rest of us who saw those numbers and you know, felt weak. Because this all of this that we're speaking about this morning, gentlemen, I mean, we're talking about essentially the tax base being eradicated, big business being ripped root and branch from any place where it can make any difference to the economy. Where are government going to get their money? And I know, Tito, we had an IMF meeting this week. Do either of you want to address that maybe? Do you think anything's going to come of it? Do you think there'll be any conditions laid down by the IMF if they are to give us more money? And what would those conditions be in your estimation?
Well, the IMF, in terms of their budget that's set aside for COVID response, doesn't have the
no conditions. Yeah.
It doesn't have the same conditions that usually go with an IMF bailout.
Right.
So I think at that level, let's just park that. I think what's of far more significance for us to get our heads around is the fact that 20th of July, publication of the Employment Equity Amendment Bill was gazetted. And effectively what this is going to do is to allow government to set targets for individual companies in terms of what proportion of racial representation they need to have and who needs to fill what positions based on race. It is fucking terrifying.
How's that going to help anything?
It is not, but you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. And that's exactly what's going on right now. I think this government gazette has pretty much slipped under the radar up until now. And the thing is that everyone is so busy trying to survive that meanwhile, the government is very carefully going about their National Democratic Revolution agenda. And
I think, you know, Gareth, you asked a fascinating question. Where's the money going to come from? And the answer is that there is no money. And the IRR launched a campaign earlier this year where we engage with embassies, the United Nations, Human Rights Council, backbench legislators in the top most prominent donor nations to the IMF, saying to them that, you know, this first IMF COVID-related thing might very well be a test balloon for a later IMF approach. And you need to know why South Africa is in the state it's in, and you need to know what you will be funding if you don't append serious conditions to any support. But I do think that one economic factoid that we need to take very seriously is that while South Africa doesn't have money, money is only a representation of value, of something of worth. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, not to sound naive or too idealistic, but I think value could be considered as what's the skill set of your country plus what's the demand for said skill set in your country. And in that regard, I think while we might have run out of money because of government, there's an untapped potential of skills and demand for said skills in this country that, if allowed, can have the same effect on the South African economy as Ludwig Erhard's policies had in the late 40s, early 50s in war-torn and war-destroyed Germany. Is the value is there. The capacity is there. Even basic skills remains embedded in much of South African culture. The only problem is that people haven't been allowed to monetize this in a way that could generate income for the individual and tax revenue for the state.
Well, I'm delighted that you managed to bring something positive in right at the end, because often we leave people feeling worse than when they started with us. But I think that is a very valid point. And I think probably something we could all focus on, because God knows we need to make a living. And individually or together as a nation, people are starting to get a little more than slightly gutful. I think that's a good point made about skills. And there are obviously people who we are going to need to put their nose to the grindstone and hopefully get this economy up and running again. I'm not hopeful the politicians will be helping us. I'm pretty sure they'll be hindering us, but we've got to do what we can.
It's not going to happen with this government in power, people. Let's be very clear about this. But I think that the promising thing is that if you look towards the next election, I find it really difficult to consider a scenario where, if the elections are not rigged, where the ANC is able to get better than 50%.
Really?
Yeah, and I think all of the numbers, Herman, I think your numbers bear this out, yes.
Yes, our estimate, we made this estimate in 2012 already, and we continue to hold to that the 2024 election is highly likely to see the ANC dip below 50%. Brief reason why: they're on the wrong side of three mega trends: education, age, and urbanization. All three are against them. It's a Herculean and almost impossible task to turn those three trends around, especially with COVID-19 acting as a trend accelerator.
And the 11 million pissed off smokers just going to the polls to vote the ANC out of power, that's going to be a lot.
That's almost as many votes as they got in the last election.
Absolutely.
Okay, so smokers could be the smokers could be the constituency to look at.
that's our smoking gun, indeed.
Oh, very good. We ended with a stupid joke as well. I love it. What a nice tidy package this burning platform has been today. Herman, thank you very much for your insights. Canton, always good to have you on the burning platform. And gentlemen, we will reconvene at the same time next week. Burning platform brought to you by Nando's. You can make sure you're a part of it next week, Thursday at 7 o'clock on cliffcentral.com. Thank you very much.
cliffcentral.com.